Hi there, esteemed audience, and welcome to another episode of Middle Grade Ninja. I'm your host, Rob Kent. As you know, I'm the author of Banneker Bones and the Giant Robot Bees, which is available as a paperback and audiobook, and the ebook is free. Free to download whenever you're watching or listening to this, wherever fine ebooks are sold. This week is the first of two Halloween episodes. We're going to be talking about small town monsters and all manner of scary things this week. And next week, we're going to have the Speed City Sisters in Crime back to talk about their new Halloween anthology, Trick or Treat. So it's all Halloween all the time for at least the next 2 weeks here at Middle Grade Ninja. And for that reason, I should let you know that under the super secret pen name Robert Kent, I've written some horror novels, and that might come in handy this time of year. You can check out All Together Now with Zombie Story, three guesses what that one's about, or The Book of David, which is a five-volume serial horror novel, which is basically my version of The Shining, involving a lot of religion, flying saucers, small-town antics, and a little Indiana town, good stuff. And you can get the first of those five volumes, The Book of David, Chapter 1 by Robert Kent, is a paperback, or guess what, the ebook is also free to download whenever you're watching or listening to this, wherever fine ebooks are sold. So there you go. I've just hooked you up with two free ebooks. That should cover you till the next episode. As always, for more information about me, more information for what's going on with the show, and interviews with thousands of agents, editors, authors, all the world's best people, head to middlegradeninja.com. Diana Rodriguez-Wallach, thank you so much for waiting through that unusually long introduction. I appreciate your patience. How are you this evening?
I am very good. Thank you for having me tonight.
I am thrilled to have you here. I heard you speak at StokerCon this year, and immediately got me excited about Small Town Monsters. I knew that was a book that I had to put on my radar. So if you would, I never summarize anybody else's biography or anyone else's book. Why would I make you sit through either of those things when you're right here? So if you would give the esteemed audience an overview of your background, and we'll go from there.
Sure. So my name is Diana Rodriguez-Wallach. I am a young adult author. Small Town Monsters just came out in September, so it's about 1 month old, which is very exciting. And it is my first young adult horror novel. I have previously published six other young adult novels. The first three were YA contemporary romances. They called it Chica Lit. They came out in way back in 2008 and 2009. So I've been at this a long time. And then I followed those up with a couple of kids. And after that, I published another trilogy called the Anastasia Phoenix Trilogy that is young adult spy thrillers that take place all throughout Europe. And the first book in that, Proof of Lies, came out in 2017, and it was a finalist for the International Thriller Awards, which was very exciting. And then Small Town Monsters just came out through Random House. So it's my first book with the Big Five, which is very exciting.
So I've got all kinds of questions for you, but obviously the place to start is I had read that a Salem, Massachusetts psychic predicted that you would go on to write children's books one day. What was that experience?
Yes. So I have listened to millions of authors and read millions of blogs where writers claim that they knew they were going to be an author when they were 2 years old and their mom published their first book when they were in preschool. And that was not my experience whatsoever. I was good at writing. I was always good at writing, and I was a journalism major in college. To me, it seemed like a very practical way to apply your writing skills to a 9-to-5 job where you would get paid. Not much, but still at least get paid. And I ended up going into journalism. I went to school in Boston University, and then I moved to New York City. I had 7 unpaid internships in college. So I was like prepared for this first job. I get there, I'm getting paid fairly decently for a reporter at that time. And then I didn't like it. So it's like, here I had all this experience, the whole degree, everything. When I get down to the job, I didn't like it. And at first I thought I didn't like what I was writing about. At the time I was working for a hotel magazine. So I thought maybe I just didn't like writing about hotels or real estate. But then I just started to have this feeling that there was something else I was supposed to be doing with my life, and I hadn't figured it out yet. I was young at the time, right out of college, and they call it the quarter life crisis. So I was trying to figure out, what is the something else? But I knew I was going to need a big push to leave journalism. I'm a very practical person. It was all that I knew. And I got a very big push. 9/11 happened. And I lived five blocks from Ground Zero on September 11th. I was a year out of college. So if you're ever going to get a push to change your life, there is none bigger than that. And I had this really dark thought at the time over and over, because I was living on Wall Street, taking the Wall Street subway, and then getting out at work, which is One Penn Plaza, which is the skyscraper above Penn Station. So I was being evacuated all the time, constantly living in this 9/11 world. And I had this dark thought of how many people went to work that day and hated their jobs. And I was too young to resign myself to that. So I was determined to figure out what it was I was going to be doing, but I didn't know what that was going to be. But I did end up quitting that first job. So I was super excited. I got a different job as a reporter. I quit my first job, and my now husband and I take this vacation around New England. We go up to Salem, Massachusetts, right around this time of year. It was in October, you know, right around Halloween. I'd never been there before, and I'd never seen a psychic before. And I wanted to give it a shot, you know, so I go in, I sit down, and I'd seen all those 2020 specials where, like, they sneakily, like, record your wallet, and they're, like, listening to your conversations in the lobby. So I was purposely being, like, super cagey and making sure they had nothing to go on. So I sit down, and she's like, what do you want to know about? And I said, my career. And she goes, okay, well, you're a writer. And I was impressed, because that's not a very common profession. And I said, yes, I'm a writer. She asked, well, what do you write about? And I didn't think I was supposed to tell her, because she was a psychic, so she should know what I write about. So I just said, business. I write about business. And she said, no, I see you writing books, little books, like children's books. And I had absolutely never considered writing a book before in my life. But then, you know, eventually my husband and I, you know, are planning our wedding. We moved back to Philadelphia, where we grew up. I'd forgotten all about the psychic. And then one night I have a dream, wake up. It was around the time I was planning my wedding. So you're having all these really vivid dreams about forgetting your dress and no one shows up. And then I had this dream that I was a young adult author, and I dreamt the entire concept of a series of books based on my experience in middle school being bullied. And I tell my husband, and he said, well, don't you remember that psychic? And I had completely forgotten about it, but I was raised Catholic. So I was like, it's a sign. So I decided I'm going to come back from my honeymoon and write a novel. And that's how I started it. I just sat down with no ambition other than just to see if I could do it. I wrote for a living every day. I wonder if I just sat down and tried to write a book by the seat of my pants, what would happen? I do. I get to the end of it and I'm like, it's not bad. So I literally Googled how to publish a book and went to Borders, which existed at the time, bought a guide to literary agents, which was like a paper book, and started the process of trying to publish my first novel.
Good for you for writing the book first. If you start with how to publish, you might never write the
book. Well, I had once met a girl at a cocktail party who had told me she had written a novel. And she hadn't published it, but I was just so impressed by the fact that she had done it, that she had written a book. So I just wanted to see if I could do it. And honestly, I didn't tell anybody I was trying to write a book until after I got an agent. I didn't even tell my parents. So the only person who knew I was even giving this a shot was my husband. It was just sort of like this pipe dream I was doing on the side after work, and really never expected to amount to anything. And now I'm here.
Were you a big reader as a young person?
Yes. So when I did end up getting an agent and I called my parents for the first time and I said, hey, I wrote a book. Their reaction was probably like any other parents. Like if I were to tell them I wanted to be like a Broadway actor or something, they were like, oh, that's great. You know, like that forced smile in their voice, because it seemed so unrealistic. And then I said to them, it's a young adult novel. And they were like, oh, I see that now. I get that. Because I read tons of young adult growing up in middle school and high school, particularly like the R.L. Stine, Fear Street was huge in the 90s. All the Christopher Pike books, I devoured all of those. So it made sense to them when I said that. And even all of my friends are like, oh, this makes sense. My voice kind of just naturally comes out sounding like a teenage girl when I write. So it's not me ever struggling to find that teenage voice. I think it comes a little more naturally because I spent so much time in the young adult reader world as a kid.
And I frequently make the joke, because it's not a joke, but it kind of is, that YA writers are people who are still trying to deal with some of the trauma that it was visited upon them in their teen years. And I know that you wrote for an anthology, What Dear Bully 70 Authors Tell Their yes. Tell Their Stories in 2011. You wrote about your experience being bullied. So that's available in a piece called Strangers on a Street. Let me think how I want to phrase this question, but more or less the gist of it is I want to know, is that something that continues to haunt you as you write for young adult, or have you been able to divorce yourself from that, or did things get better for you past middle school and okay, I have plenty of positive YA experiences now to draw on?
So that essay that you reference is or was the basis for that first novel I ever wrote, which was never published. It did land me my first agent, but that book never published, but it was based on that middle school experience. It was my, like, what do they call it? Nom de plume, where you're just thinly veiling your life in fiction. So that experience definitely stuck with me. And I think because I had a difficult time in middle school and struggled in high school. So 90s was very grunge, very dirty hair and flannel and all of that. And it's not who I authentically am. I was very into the music to some extent. I went to Lollapalooza and all of that. But I felt like I spent a good time of high school trying to pretend I was something that I wasn't. And now, as an author, I can tap into those emotions pretty easily because I remember what that felt like, and I can lend those experiences authentically to my characters. I think if you were super happy and you look back at high school as being your peak and your golden years, I don't know, it might be hard to pull material from that if it was the happiest time of your life. So I think having an angsty, my so-called life kind of teenage experience does help me in my writing.
How do you keep your, as you get older, you're a mother now, and you get further and further from teen you, how do you keep teen you still fresh in your mind so you can draw on her when you need her?
Well, now my daughter is 10, so I'm sort of getting a teenager coming up the back end. So I'm getting a refresher course on what it feels like to be insecure and angsty and worried about what your friends think of you. So I kind of live and breathe it every day, but from the parental angle. I joke that it's every parent's curse when they say, I hope you have a kid just like you. You know, because now I'm watching my daughter go through the exact same experiences. So I do get to tap into those emotions fairly regularly. And I also enjoy young adult literature. I enjoy young adult movies and TV shows. So naturally, I consume a lot of that art and keep myself in that headspace.
Well, now that you're publishing and promoting your own novels, what are your reading habits?
I usually have a couple of books going at once. So I just discovered Audible around the new year, and I'm loving that. So I usually have one audiobook going, and I try to pick the absolute longest one I can find, because you only get like one free Audible book a month that you can pick any book. So I pick the ones that are at least like 20 hours long, so I know it'll make it through the whole month. And I have one of those going, which is what I listen to like in the car or while I'm getting ready or making dinner. And then I read mostly on my Kindle at night before I go to bed, and I do consume a lot of horror and young adults. In the Audible, I'll do anything, you know, mostly adult, but in Kindle, it's mostly, you know, YA and horror, just to keep myself fresh on what's been done before and what tropes are overdone and what I do and don't like that's going on in the genre. And then if I'm reading a hardback book, it's usually something that's older and classic from like a used bookstore, like an old Stephen King that's like this thick, you know, sitting on my lap. And I'll sometimes reference that during the day, like when I'm stuck and just need a little inspiration.
Stephen King, great wrist strengtheners, those old Stephen King hardbacks.
You can't read that on the treadmill. Like you need a stand to put the stand on.
You can, you just don't need any weights with it. Like, you can start. I can't remember. I remember when it was my first adult novel, and it was a secret from my parents, and I had it in the bottom of my backpack, and that was just the heaviest, biggest book to try to hide.
I know. When I was reading that, I had just reread it recently. My kids saw it and they were like, what is it? Like, is it the phone book? Like they actually didn't know what a phone book was. They thought it was like an encyclopedia, like a dictionary. They couldn't fathom what this ginormous thing of pages was. And it was just a normal novel that somebody just wrote one story that was this big. Yeah.
What's your favorite Stephen King novel?
That's a tough one. I do love It. I was a big fan of It, but there is a scene at the end of It that I'm not a fan of that changes my perception. That's not in any of the movies. I don't know if it's a spoiler, but there is a scene where, you know, the kids are having a sexual experience and they are 12-year-old children. And I was not prepared for that scene. And I thought the depiction of it was just a little yikes to me. But other than that, if you take that chapter out, I loved that book. I think the eeriness of Derry, Maine is such an inspiration. I think all of the characters in The Stand kind of blow me away. How you could have that many different characters and that many different personalities. And as a reader, I was able to keep them all straight. And that's something that's very difficult to do when you have a lot of characters. I've read other books that had multiple characters where it wasn't just two or three, but we're talking, you know, half a dozen or more, where I really did forget who was this again. Oh, wait, is that his sister? Is that his brother? And you can't remember how they connect. And I felt The Stand managed to really do that and keep those voices distinctive. So as a writer, I see some of his works as just a really good masterclass on how to do some of the best horror and how to weave together some of these really difficult techniques.
And you'd written your romance books, you'd written spy thrillers, and now we're finally getting to the horror. Had you always wanted to write horror and it just hadn't been the right time, or have you been saving this for a special occasion? Why horror? Why now?
So as a kid, like as a middle schooler and a high schooler, that's what I've read. You know, looking back, all the Fear Streets and the Christopher Pikes all tread the line of being either paranormal thriller or paranormal horror, whatever you want to call it. That's what interests me. I also watched a lot of horror movies as a middle schooler. All the Freddy Krueger movies were the big ones when I was growing up. I was in that generation. Scream, I loved all of those. I think I started with contemporary because it seemed easier. My first books I wrote as a pantser by the seat of my pants with just a concept. And because the dream was about my middle school experience, I tended to stick with that old adage of write what you know. So I literally wrote about my own teenage life. Amour and Summer Secrets, my first book, is about a girl who's half Polish and half Puerto Rican growing up in the Philadelphia suburbs, and then goes back to Utuado, Puerto Rico, which is the town my dad is literally from. So a lot of that pulls from my own life. When my family read that book, they saw themselves on those pages. I think as I grew as a writer, I felt more confident in branching out and away from my own life and taking more risks creatively. The spy thrillers were a little based on, I do love those. I loved Alias. I loved Jason Bourne. I loved all of those spy shows. And in college, I had a professor who was the former deputy director of disinformation for Czechoslovakia during the Cold War. And his job was, this was before Trump existed as a political figure, before disinformation was a word that everybody knew. So he had this specialty where he had to convince the world that the Nazis were still up to no good. So everyone would be looking over here and not paying attention to what the Communist Party, his party, was actually doing. And he was very good at his job. And then Russia invaded the country and he fled to America and ended up teaching at Boston University, teaching reporters how to tell when they are being fed false information. And I remembered that story when I had this idea of like, wouldn't it be cool to write this thriller set all over Europe about spies? And because I was still in that old adage of write what you know, I didn't feel comfortable writing about an actual government organization like the CIA or Mossad or something where you would have to have a lot of technical information to make the story seem legitimate. So I instead decided to come up with this like private spy organization that you would kind of like spies for hire, and I could give them a specialty. And I gave them the specialty of disinformation because I was a former journalist. I was a journalism student. It was something I knew, and I was able to then play upon major conspiracy theories in the news in the past several decades and twist them up for my book. And that was a lot of fun. You know, and so I started to lean a little darker, you know, going from the contemporary to the thriller. And then Small Town Monsters just came about while I was watching the Conjuring film for the first time. Like I said, I love horror movies. I was watching that film. If you haven't seen it, it is a movie that is based on the true story of Ed and Lorraine Warren, who were the demonologists from Connecticut. They're extremely Catholic, and they were hired by the Catholic Church to investigate various activity, paranormal phenomenon, or suspicion of exorcisms, or any sort of demonic activity. So they were most famous for working on the Amityville house in Long Island and on the Annabelle doll. And the movie shows them off on a case and their daughter being at home in Connecticut and starting to get haunted by all these objects that they kept in their basement. They would go on these jobs and bring the objects home with them, lock them in their little basement of their normal looking suburban house, have them blessed by the church, but they figured, oh, well, they're safer in our basement than out in the world. And here their daughter starts getting attacked by one of them. So I paused the film. And I was like, oh my God, did they really have a daughter? So I Googled it and I was like, yes, they really do have a daughter. And this was in 2019 when I started writing. And at that time, Lorraine Warren was still alive and you could still go to her actual house and tour these demonic artifacts in her actual basement, which is just crazy to me. And I just started imagining what it must have been like for that girl to grow up in that world where her parents were exorcists and the proof was like right there in her basement. And having a daughter myself, I was just imagining, would I be cool with it if my daughter came home and said she wanted to go sleep over at a friend's house whose parents were demonologists and had a basement full of demonic stuff downstairs? Like, that must have completely affected this girl's life growing up. And interestingly enough, there are not a lot of interviews with her and not a lot of photos with her. She is married and her husband was the head of the Warren Occult Museum in their former childhood home, which the town has since shut down. You know, after Lorraine Warren died, I think they found some sort of zoning violation to sort of close it down. But he is also still the head of the Paranormal Society. So her marriage, her relationship is still ensconced in that world, but not a lot about what she felt like growing up. So I just sort of imagined that and created the Martinez family. I made them Hispanic because, let's face it, there are a lot of Catholics out there who are Hispanic, and that's my background. And there aren't a lot of horror novels featuring Latinos. So I wanted to put that into a novel and imagine what that world must be like.
So, well, it's lots of follow-up questions. Let's start with Ed and Lorraine Warren. Obviously, the Conjuring films are documentaries, each and every one, 100%. But do you believe their story? Do you think that those artifacts were genuinely haunted?
Yes. I mean, I don't know if I believe every single one of their stories, and I could say I'm sure there are some exaggerations in there to gain notoriety, But I was raised Catholic. So if you're going to believe in the good place, it's hard not to believe in the bad place. It's hard to believe that, your grandma's up there with Hitler. That doesn't make sense. So I can believe in evil. I watched a really interesting TED talk about the nature of evil. And I think there's a lot to it about that evil is a force in this world, and there's something yet you can't explain, so I think that there is something to the demonic, and that's one of the reasons I wrote the book. I wrote What Scares Me. The Exorcist is absolutely the scariest thing I've ever seen in my life. The book is equally as scary, and I think that's something that definitely scares me. I believe in, the ghosts and the haunting. That's why I never went to the Warren Occult Museum. I could have gone in 2019. She was alive. The basement was open. I live in Philly. Connecticut's not that far away. And I did debate it. I was like, should we go? Should we go see it? And then there was a piece of me. It's like, no, I can't do it. Like, I'm definitely afraid that something's gonna like jump on my back and follow me home. So yeah, there's definitely a little piece of me that believes in it enough that I'm not walking in there and touching the Annabelle doll.
Yeah, you have to be careful when especially when you write horror, about what you go looking for, what kind of research you do. Do you want to be dwelling on this thing for the next however many months or years it's going to take you to work on your novel?
Oh my God, so my family is extremely Catholic, my older brother especially. When I told him I was writing this book, we had this long dinner and he like tried to talk me out of it. He's like, I really think it's dangerous for you to be putting your mindset in this horror world and what you may attract into your life. It's kind of like the law of attraction. So if you're writing it something dark, are you going to attract something dark into your life? And thankfully, so far, that has not happened. So I seem safe. And I was able to tell them at my book launch party the day before. I was part of Philadelphia's Latin American Book Festival. And as part of that, they honestly had a baptism for all of the books that came out that fall. And so my book was literally baptized and blessed with flower petals. So I think we're good now. Like, we're safe.
It didn't start to sizzle and smoke came out of its
No. Yeah.
One thing that I've not seriously worried about, but considered from time to time, is having written the Book of David available now, which features alien abduction among other wonderful things. I think, if I ever get abducted by aliens, having written this book ahead of time, no one will ever believe that
That
it happened. I have written
is
myself into
totally true.
a corner.
Yes, I mean, if you ever found out Stephen King was being haunted, wouldn't you be like, well, that makes sense? Like, he had it coming.
If he takes off the Stephen King mask and it was really a dark demon all along,
Yes.
fair enough.
Yep.
Should have seen that one coming. It's always who you
Yep.
think it is. So if you were someone you love, God forbid, were to become possessed by a demon, what are you going to do now? You've written the book. You're in
I
trouble.
know, I know, I know. I'd have to consult the church and hope they believe me. Well, if you follow exorcism, so I did a lot of research on exorcisms, obviously, before I read the book. They're not as uncommon as you would think. In some cultures, I watch exorcisms that look like you were going to a doctor's office and they were just walking in and they're like, hey, bub, how was your day? And he's like, oh, tough day at work. Then he sits down and starts performing an exorcism and the guy starts speaking in tongues and his eyes are rolling back. But up until that point, it just seemed like a really normal day. So it was weird to see that type of exorcism and not the pea soup head spinning around in circles. I also learned that in 2015, a Catholic cardinal performed an exorcism on the entire country of Mexico because he was just convinced that with all the drugs and the murders and the danger that was happening in the country, that the whole country needed an exorcism, and a cardinal, not some like rogue priest, performed an exorcism. So it's not as uncommon as you would think. I think it's more common in Latin America because there are a lot of Catholics in Latin America, and I think it's surprisingly common in the US more than you might think.
Well, and there might also be just the demons like the nicer weather. It's warm.
Attracted to the heat. Yeah. Doesn't feel at home.
So, well, I've got all kinds of questions for you about possession and all that fun stuff, but probably where we should start is if, as I promised, I will not summarize your book. So what does esteemed audience need to know about Small Town Monsters, which is available right now, and they could be adding it to their cart as they're listening to us?
Yes. So as I said, the book started as just imagining what it would have been like to be the daughter of demonologists. And I gave that to a Latin American family because, as many of you know, there are not a lot of Latin American horror novels or even not a lot of Latinx children's books. So I'm hoping to add a little representation to the genre. And the story features two characters, Vera and Max, who are growing up in a town called Roaring Creek, Connecticut, that has seen its fair share of tragedy. Vera is the daughter of the demonologist, and Max believes that there's something very wrong happening with his mother. And as he tries to seek out Vera's help while her parents are away on business, they start to realize that it may not just be his mother, and it may be something that's spreading through the entire town. And there is a heavy cult aspect in the book. In 2019, when I was writing it, Nexium was really big, which is the cult that was sort of like a self-help group out of Albany, New York, that turned out to have a really dark underbelly where they were abusing women sexually and otherwise. And that was very much in my brain. It was also the run-up to the election, which was a pretty dark year. So I had a lot of time thinking about groupthink during that time and how we were all on separate camps and absolutely convinced and believing what we believed and couldn't hear a word from the other side. Even if some of the things that people were believing were crazy conspiracy theories, they were locked into those beliefs. And I added some of those cult aspects to the novel as Vera and Max realized that what's happening to his mom is really much bigger than they ever thought.
Nexium broke my heart just because Allison Mack was my dream woman from Smallville. Although I have always thought the conflict of Smallville was Clark's an idiot. He wants to get with Lana the whole time, and Allison Mack, Chloe Sullivan, is right there. And I thought, well, eventually they'll reveal she's Lois Lane, and all my dreams will come true. And spoiler alert, that's not what happened. So that was
she was the villain of Nexium. See, I was not a huge Smallville person. I'm not a huge superhero person. So I was more shocked when I watched the documentaries of how many faces I did recognize her face, but how many other faces I recognized in like the wedding scenes from various TV shows I had seen. And I mean, if you just think of Scientology, I mean, Scientology has so many celebrities in it and how easy it can be to get wrapped up in that. When I was in college, I went to school in Boston. Boston is a huge college town. There's about 100 universities in the city limits. So there's all these 20-somethings walking around. One day I'm walking through Kenmore Square right by Fenway Park. And this kid who looks like a skater in the 90s, you know, with the big baggy shorts and the dirty hair, stops me and he's like, hey, you know, what are you doing tonight? You want to come hang out? And it was a pretty common thing, you know, when you're a college student to be stopped and invited to a party. And he's like, yeah, you know, this group of friends and I are getting together and we do this cool thing. We have this personality test and it's really awesome. You can learn all about yourself. It's so fun. You'll meet some really cool people. Do you want to go? And I'm like, well, you know, I was smart enough as a young woman to, you know stranger danger and not just go with some random guy to his house. So of course I said, no, I go back to the dorms and I found out that one of my friends did go with one of these guys. And it turned out it was Scientology. She shows up there and it was the first meeting to induct her into Scientology. And it was so easy to see how you could take that first step when all you were seeking was to hang out with a bunch of cool people and they seemed really nice and you're taking a Cosmo quiz, you know, it's fun. You love those, don't you? And here you are at your first cult meeting.
Well, with something like, I don't know, Heaven's Gate or Waco, the Waco, Texas group, right? The Branch Davidians. It's like, yeah, well, fair enough. They're out in the middle of nowhere. There's not a whole lot going on. If the cable gets shut down, what else are you going to do with your time?
Yeah.
But when you're talking about, you know, Allison Mack and other celebrities, people who supposedly have it all on the ball, like, didn't you just come from some ridiculous Hollywood party? Why do you also need a cult? It's like, nope, I guess it's just susceptibility at all levels of society.
Yeah, and honestly, I listened to a lot of the actual NXIVM audio of their, I don't know what to say, sermons. I'm not sure of the videos of Keith Raniere speaking to his members and giving advice. I also listened to a lot of the Jonestown sermons and Jim Jones, who was the drink the Kool-Aid guy from the 70s. And if you we talked about evil and whether evil exists. You know, when you listen to Keith Raniere of NXIVM, you could just hear a narcissist and somebody who believed that he was God, honestly, and every word he said just deserved to be followed. Whereas with Jonestown, there is an actual audio on YouTube, and I caution this is like a trigger. Don't go looking for it if you don't want to hear it, of the actual moment where he is telling his 2,000 plus followers to drink the Kool-Aid. And it is the actual audio of them choosing to do it. And you can hear the crowd just getting quieter and quieter as they're slowly dying. And there are children in the crowd, there's crying, there's screaming. And his voice in this audio is the closest I've ever heard to true evil in the world. I mean, that listening to his voice convinces you that evil is a force. It's not just a person. Like there, that is the closest you will ever hear to the devil is coming out of this man's voice as he's convincing these people to kill themselves. Before 9/11, they said it was the single biggest incidence of mass death of Americans in history on one day. And that was Jonestown. And he convinced these people who initially joined a church in California and thought that they were going to do charity work and he was healing the sick and could make people walk again. And for some reason, they followed him to those jungles and followed him until they drank poison, knowing they were drinking poison. And it is just really, really disturbing. It will convince you that evil exists.
It's one thing, of course, when a cult is, you know, it's a specific organized group, and you get in, and it's a questionnaire, and then slowly but surely, you know, you're a frog in the pot. You don't realize the water is boiling until it's the command, "Hey, drink the Kool-Aid." I know they had run Kool-Aid drinking drills for a year or two beforehand, where that was eventually going to be the plan. So that when it actually was the plan, there were some who thought, "Well, this is just another drill," but. That's one thing, but now that, you know, we've seen what happens with Facebook and getting back to disinformation, I've got relatives that I consider to be in a death cult because they won't get vaccinated, they won't get masked, they're reading QAnon nonsense, some of it disseminated through their church. And well, that's a cult. It's just a very big cult that's spread out across the country. Is
Absolutely.
that still a cult, or is what is that, and how much of that horrifying thing that, you know, you've been living in the same world I have for the past however many years where this has been happening, how much of that fed into small town monsters?
A lot. That fed into it a lot. So I've been asked the question often, why do you think there are so many horror novels coming out right now? Because it does seem to be a big boom, not only in young adult, but even in adult, even in movies. There seems to be a huge horror boom coming out right now. I'm like, well, trace it back. The movies and the books coming out in 2021 were most often written in 2019. They were written during the run-up to the election. And that was a really dark year. I know we all are focused on the darkness of 2020, but 2019, you know, as we were all listening to what was going on Twitter on a daily basis, was a really dark year. And I'm logging on to Facebook, just as you said, and seeing people who I knew in real life, who I talked to at school reunions and had a lovely conversation with, who absolutely were convinced that Anderson Cooper drinks the blood of babies and that Mother Teresa was sex trafficking children and that Tom Hanks is a cannibal. And they were sharing this on Facebook with no shame or concern of who was going to see this, that people were going to think that this was crazy, you know, that this wasn't quite right. And I was just stunned and how they could wholeheartedly believe this. And even when it was proven false, even when you have things like Pizzagate that are proven to be completely false, does not shake your belief. You are still convinced in what you believe. Even a million times over, when Trump was caught in a lie, you were still convinced that he tells it like it is and tells the truth. And it seemed to be nothing that was going to shake you, like scientific evidence of the coronavirus and the vaccines. So a lot of that did feed into the cult in Small Town Monsters, because it sort of starts as a town in a very dark place. And there had been a horrible tragedy in the town. Many of them are grieving and they're looking for a group to make them feel better, a self-help group, a support group. And it was a mixture of that, of how a group that you join with the best of intentions can turn ugly, because that is one of the lines that came out of one of the NXIVM documentaries, which was a member said, nobody sets out to join a cult. None of us thought we were joining a cult. It's just by the time it became apparent to us, we had sunk in years of our lives and thousands of dollars, and it was just hard to see our way out of it. At the same time, I started to think about what would make you take that first step to join such an extreme self-help group that you are spending thousands of dollars, or you are believing something that goes against reasons. What would make you take that first step? And I figured you would have to personally be in a very dark place, something going wrong in your life. Let's face it, if everything's great and sunshine and roses, you're probably not out there seeking extreme self-help groups. And at that time, and you know, in the past 10 years or so, I've had friends or family who have sadly not only lost relatives, but lost children, you know, whether it be miscarriage or stillborn or sudden infant death. And these experiences were horrible and tragic, and watching them go through it was gut-wrenching. And as a parent, I remember thinking to myself, you would do just about anything to prevent this from happening. And how many people would offer up that prayer? I'll do anything. I'll do absolutely anything if you make this not happen. And what if you found out that that prayer was being answered by the dark place and not the good place? Would you still make that deal? If it's for your own kid, you very well might, you know, but what if you found out the adverse effects would be on other people, but it would save your own kid, but all these other people might be damaged? Would you still make that deal? And it's not totally cut and dry, black and white, on what you might do and what might get you to take that first step into a darker world.
Well, something I wanted to ask you about a few things I wanted to ask you. Well, let's start with this. Who is the ideal reader for this story? Who are you most hoping that this is going to reach?
So they say the book is for teenagers. I think all YA, they say 12 and up. I find a lot of my books are read by adults. So I think it's about 50-50 between being read by adults and teenagers. I'm often asked, I was just at a book festival in Lititz, Pennsylvania, which is in the Bible Belt of Pennsylvania, in the middle of the state. And there were a lot of teachers and librarians there, and they asked me what it was about. I told them it was a horror novel, and they said, is it clean? So to them, they wanted to know, does it say the F word, and is there any sex in the book? So I can say it doesn't say the F word, and there is no sex in the book. So in that respect, it's clean. In the demonic possession, evil creepiness thing, you know, they were fine with that. So it depends on, you know, the parent and what you're worried about your kid reading. But if you're cool with horror and you don't get scared easily, then I think the book is for you. I also love that it has a male and a female point of view. So I think it appeals more to boys than any of my other books have. And I have gotten a lot of feedback from male readers. So I think that's something new for this book for me. I'd never written a book from the male point of view. So I think it has a little bit more outreach in that respect.
When did you know this would be a dual perspective story?
Honestly, right away, I instantly, when I had the thought of Vera, I'm like, okay, well, she would be swept up in investigating something but the action is happening somewhere else. It's happening in someone else's house. So if she's only showing up after the fact, she wouldn't be there for all of the good stuff. And so in order for somebody to be there for all of the good stuff, you have to have a point of view of somebody in that house. And to me, it was just Max. He just came to my head immediately that I wanted the energy to be a male and a female character rather than two female characters.
When you sit down with an idea like this, how much do you have the whole thing? Do you have some sort of vague outline? What do you start with when you get going?
So normally I start with the premise. I'm a plotter. You'll hear a lot of authors say that they don't have a lot of plot and they, you know, are mostly character this. And for me, I always have way too much plot and I end up having to scale it a lot back to fit a typical word length of a young adult novel. So I always have a ton of plot. So that's where I start with the concept. And then when I get the characters all formulating in my head, I usually ask three questions of every single character in the story, not just the main character, but the side characters as well, which is, what do they fear? What do they want? And what are they willing to do to get it? And I think if you can answer those questions really in depth, you're already on your way to your character arc, to feeling how your character is going to change by the end of it in order to get what it is that they want.
You sit down and actually write that out in a separate sheet?
I do. I write down a lot of, I have big artist sketchbooks, you know, that you would buy at CVS, the big spiral, huge sketchbooks. And I do write a lot of my character stuff on there. And I write my day-to-day stuff. So as I'm writing the book, I'll write in that sketchbook, like what I'm going to write tomorrow, like what the next scene is. But my actual overarching plot, I tend to dictate into the notes app of my phone. I think better when I'm walking or moving. So I'll walk around outside or on the treadmill and I'll just dictate into my phone what the plot is and what the characters are and what the plot holes might be. And if he does this and how does it affect that? And I dictate all that into my notes app and then import that into Microsoft Word, make sense of it, you know, try to form it into an outline. And then I write the whole thing in Scrivener, which is a, you know, a novel writing software app.
And so what does your average workday look like then?
Well, it depends. Life is good now. My kids are back at school. So when I was writing Small Town Monsters, I was also teaching virtual kindergarten. So try doing the virtual kindergarten and virtual fourth grade and getting up at 5 o'clock in the morning to write for a couple of hours before school started at 9 o'clock. And I had to make sure my kids sat in front of a computer and didn't get up and pet the cat. So Small Town Monsters was definitely an experience in the working parent finding the minutes wherever they could. I basically worked all weekends through 2020. So all day Saturday and Sundays were my work days. I locked myself in my guest room and would write for 12 hours straight for both days, Saturdays and Sundays. And then Monday would start and I would just have these couple of hours if I woke up super early. And then I had to be, you know, the homeroom mom watching and making sure my kids did school. This year they're back. They're back in school. So this is the first like couple of weeks where I actually have a full work day again from like 9 to 4. It's amazing. I don't know what to do with my time. I'm like, oh my gosh, I can actually think through the whole chapter and not have to stop, you know, because somebody wants pretzels. So it's been kind of nice. So right now, I've been doing a lot of promo for Small Town Monsters. That has been my primary focus the last couple of months. And now I am plotting my next novel. So I am in that process of dictating into my phone. Typically when I start writing, if it's a day like it is right now where I get full work days, I try to write at least 2,000 words a day if I can do it. And then usually I'll hit a point around like 40% of the way through the book where I'm convinced that it sucks and everything's falling apart and this is terrible and I'm never going to be able to fit this whole plot into 70,000 words. So then I'll take what I call a writing retreat. I'll usually go to one of my relatives' houses when they're on vacation. Thankfully, I have a lot of in-laws who live within just, you know, less than an hour's drive from me. And whenever they go away, I move into their house by myself for like 2 to 3 days and just write the entire time until I fix whatever is wrong with the book. And then I can come home and really like plow through the end of it, because now I've kind of figured out all the problems and the plot holes. And that's been my MO, even going back to Proof of Lies, is when I had time, I would still take these writing retreats. Every single book, I hit that like moment of desperation where I'm convinced it's terrible and I need this break to like focus and figure it all out. And then I can move on once I have that concentrated, straight time to just think.
At this point, does it get any easier? Because you say, oh, I'm still me. And this is that point that I always reach on every novel. So calm down. It's probably not that bad. Or is it still just panic every time?
It's not panic. It's more frustration. Because if you're in the middle and your brain is figuring out the plot hole and why this isn't working, and then the school bus comes, I just get really frustrated that I didn't get to finish that thought process. You know, I'm constantly interrupted. So having those 3 days of uninterrupted time allows me to fix what I need to fix and know that my brain never leaves the story. And I'm in there, and I'm from the minute I wake up to the minute I go to bed, and I can think through without any of those interruptions, without making anyone dinner, without, you know, packing school lunches, and just really plow through it. It's that just clears my head and fixes the plot for me. So it's not like panic so much as just having that frustration lifted and having that time.
And are you still reading fiction while you're writing?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. I used to, in my early books, when I was writing my first three books, the Amor and Summer Secrets series, they are in the first person past tense. And they're in one point of view. And I found if I was reading a book that was in the third person or in the present tense or in multiple points of view, it would screw me up. I would then, you know, sit down to write and I would be, I would have this other tense or this other point of view in my head. And I found it hard to then get back to the first person past tense. That doesn't really affect me anymore. So I think as I've gotten older, I don't find other people's writing affects my own writing as I did in the beginning. So in the very beginning, I wouldn't read any young adult or any contemporary while I was writing it because I was worried it would bleed in, or that, you know, I would suddenly start writing in the third person, even though that wasn't what the book was in. You know, I don't have that anymore. I think I'm a little more seasoned in that respect. And I do like to stay on top of the trends. I've had multiple agents in my career, and I've learned that it is important to know what's in their slush pile and what's been done a million times. And if you're not reading heavily in your genre, you're not going to have those answers. And it's just going to hurt you in the back end when you go on submission. So it's kind of saves you a little bit of time to really stay up on your genre.
Well, I suspect that when I'm reading other authors, they bleed in a little bit to what I'm writing, to which I say, great, help me out. I appreciate the bleeding. Mm-hmm. Please, by all means, inspire me.
Well, I mean, in some respects, I'll say that the town of Derry, Maine influenced Roaring Creek in the concept that I didn't want to write a possession story, an exorcism story that was just about one character, which is what it typically is, you know, Reagan from The Exorcist, or Emily Rose in The Exorcism of Emily Rose. And usually these movies or books focus on one possessed character. And I wanted to create that creepy town, a whole town where everyone was kind of under the influence of evil. And I can clearly say that, you know, Derry, Maine is a huge inspiration to a ton of horror writers. That is just an iconic town in horror. And so I feel like if it's bleeding in that way, great. You know, like I don't feel like that is a danger. You know, where it's a danger is if it's bleeding in like to your sentences, like that's a problem. So you got to make sure you're not reading too deeply, but you know, being inspired by somebody's town is not problematic and can give you a lot of different ways to take your stories.
Well, something that strikes me as amusing is I've had some friends who grew up non-religious And then they would watch The Exorcist and they'd be like, what's the big deal, man? It's just a little girl. It's fine. And I grew up extremely religious, and I know you did as well. And it was the most terrifying thing I'd ever seen.
Oh, absolutely. And so people ask me, is it scary? And I always say, well, it depends on how Catholic you grew up, or it depends, on what you believe. Like, if you believe in ghosts, if you believe in the demonic, if you believe that that spiritual thing exists, if evil exists, and you're going to be scared by it. But if that's not what scares you, then, then be honest about it. I think one of the reasons there's a lot more women writing horror now is because for decades it was a male-dominated genre, and what they were creating wasn't necessarily what scared us. And the characters, the male characters were that they were creating didn't speak to us. Or if there were female characters, we were reading them, we're like, she wouldn't do that. Hence that one scene in It. I was reading that I'm like, that is just no, that is not how a 12-year-old girl would act or experience or react to anything. So I feel like women are kind of stepping up now and writing what scares them, and it's a little bit different than what's been done before.
Well, speaking of different than what's been done before, when you come to the demonic possession genre, one, you've got instances of actual possession. Well, what we assume is actual possession. You can go and you can watch those videos on YouTube, and presumably possession fans have, and if they haven't yet, they will. So there's that. There's all these different archetypes of what the possession story is. How do you carve out the Diana Rodriguez Wallach? This is what my possessions look like.
So, I mean, you're trying to pull from a bunch of different influences. I was inspired a little bit by Latin American folklore. And one of the reasons that exorcism happened in Mexico in 2015 is because of a rise in idol worship in marginalized or poor communities in Mexico, where they were praying to Santa Muerte, which is literally seeing death. But it's mostly people who feel like they are being overlooked by the Catholic Church, or they are in extreme poverty, or maybe they are involved in the drug culture and they believe that death is imminent and God may not hear their prayers, but maybe this other idol will. And the Catholic Church, being the Catholic Church, is not a huge fan of any other idol worship. It's up there in the commandments, so you could see why they would take a hard line against that. But the idea of worshiping an idol is prevalent in tons of cultures, not just Latin America. But I mean, you can go back to the Grim Reaper. I mean, that goes back to Spanish colonizers, and that existed. And a lot of satanic cults, if you go back to the Satanic Panic, it was all about a satanic altar and leaving offerings on an altar. And even if it was body parts and stuff, which sort of came up in some of my research, the Chicago Ripper crew that existed during the 80s and were slaughtering women and leaving these body parts. And it was really twisted. So the idea of praying to an idol, praying on an altar, and leaving offerings and expecting your prayers to be answered was sort of where I took my demonic story. You have this cult, you start in a good place, you start as just a self-help group, and by the time you're good and brainwashed, they're like, what if you just leave a few, let me show you this other thing that will really change your life and really kick it up to the next level. It's just this little statue, just leave it a few offerings and it'll answer your prayers. And if you're in a dark place, maybe you'd give it a shot. There are a lot of kooky things out there that people give it a try when they're in a desperate place because, hey, can't hurt, right? Like, let's just give it a shot and see what happens. And what if what happens is it's connected to a demonic force?
Well, the esteemed audience knows I'm going to ask sooner or later, so now seems to be a good place. Diana Rodriguez Wallach, have you ever seen a flying saucer and or a ghost and or a demon?
So I have tons of ghost stories. So I have not seen a flying saucer, and I hope I have not seen a demon. But my first house that my husband and I bought when we were in our 20s was in South Philadelphia. It was in a Queen Village. It was built in 1832. Okay, so it's one of those old Philadelphia brick houses. It was called a Trinity. So that means there's one room per floor. The kitchen is in the basement, and then there's a living room, and then a bedroom, and then another, what was a bedroom. And in the, they had a back courtyard that had an outhouse, which I know because there was a sinkhole and all of our outhouses sunk on the whole block, and it was really creepy. So it was a very old house, and it had like original floors, original fireplaces in every room. And when we moved in, we were like, wow, how many people do you think died here? Like, my goodness, this house is 175 years old. You know, not just a casual person died here. Like, this must have racked up some bodies. So we kind of like made jokes about it as we were fixing up the house, and it did need a lot of work. And we did a lot of great things, renovations and stuff. Then one day I'm sitting upstairs, and I may have actually been working on what became my first novel at the time. I'm by myself and I hear music playing. It's piano music. And initially I thought, oh my God, my neighbor Vicky has gotten really good. Wow. Like, she sounds amazing because she had a piano. And then, like any good horror movie, I realized that the sounds are coming from inside the house. So I go downstairs and I realize I had a boombox in my bedroom. So this was the early 2000s. For those of you who don't know what a boombox is, you know, it was those old stereos that had the radio and the CD player and the tape deck. And every morning before I went to my day job, I would listen to the morning radio, and you had like the Z Morning Zoo type of thing. So if you know about boomboxes, if you leave it on the radio function, you turn it off and you go to work, that's where it should be when you turn it back on when you get home. So out of nowhere, when I'm sitting in this house by myself, the radio had turned itself on, had switched to the CD function, and had started playing. And it started playing a CD that I had in there. It was only a one disc CD player, and it was classical piano music because I was picking out the ceremony songs for our upcoming wedding. So Bach's Air on a G-String starts playing. And, you know, I investigated everything on this radio. It did not have a sleep function. It did not have an alarm. It did not have a power surge or anything like that. You know, all the lights were working, everything was fine. So I tell my, you know, soon-to-be husband what happened. He doesn't believe me. He does not believe in ghosts. He's Jewish. You know, he doesn't believe in, you know, the demonic or spirits or any of that. So he thinks I'm crazy, okay? So then I start coming home from work, and every randomly, certain days, not every day, but certain days, the radio would be on and it would have been switched to the CD function, and the CD had clearly played while I was at work. Even though when I had left that day, I had been listening to the radio and turned it off. So I'm like, somehow this radio is turning itself on. Then one day, my husband comes home. He's in the bedroom. He's changing the sheets. It's on a Saturday now, not a work day. And all of a sudden the radio turns on. It starts playing Bach's Air on a G-String. He comes booking upstairs, screaming, completely freaked out. He finally believes me. He's like, yes, something's going on. I don't know why this radio is playing. So I tell one of my friends who's all into like the spiritual new wave type of stuff. She's like, ghosts just want to be acknowledged. You know, they just want you to talk to them. So I'm like, okay. So first I have to tell you, we actually tested out our theory. We took out the piano music and we put in Bon Jovi's Living on a Prayer. And we left it in there for several weeks. And not once did the radio play. Not once did I come home from work and find that the radio was on or the CD had played. Okay. So I come back. We were like, let's do it another try. We put the piano music back in. Instantly, it starts happening all over again. So I decide to take my friend's advice. I walk into my house after work when my husband's not there to hear me do this and embarrass me. And I literally start talking to the ghosts in my living room. And I'm like, hey, how's it going? You know, I just want to thank you for having us here in your house. I know you guys have probably been here a long time. And it's clear that you love piano music. You know, it probably was the music that you listened to when you lived here. If you could just play the CD only on Mondays through Fridays from 9 to 5 when I'm at work, that's totally fine. But if you could not play the CD, you know, while I'm at home, I would appreciate it because it really freaks me out. So I say that, it never happened again. I would come home from work. I would find that the CD had played, but it never turned on again while my husband and I were in the house to experience it or witness it turn on. So it absolutely worked. Also, when I lived in that same house, it is the only time in my life that I ever sleepwalked. So never before, never since had I ever been a sleepwalker. These trinities, like I said, are one room per floor, and they are cavernous spiral staircases with the little triangular steps that your foot barely fits on top of. So you can trip up these stairs on a good day completely sober, okay? And I would wake up and find myself on the top floor of my house, sitting back straight on my sofa, and I'd wake up and like just make my hands folded on my lap, and I was sitting there. I'd walk downstairs to my bedroom, and I would see that my sheets had been peeled back in a perfect triangle. They're not rumpled, they're not tossed to the floor. Doesn't look like I threw them off. It looked like somebody, like your mom, just peeled them back and guided you out of bed. And this happened several times when I was living in the house. Has never happened to me since. And let's see, I woke up once also in this house where I felt like somebody was sitting on my chest. And my eyes were open, and I remember having this thought, like, my eyes are open. I am awake, but I cannot move. I absolutely could not move, and I'm looking around, and it felt like there was just somebody full out sitting on my chest. I couldn't move. I couldn't speak. I'm blinking, and all of a sudden, you know, after a few moments, it goes away. Whatever it was got off my chest, and I could breathe again. And I told my family what happened, and my sister had recently gotten married. Her husband is Thai. He's from Thailand, and they have a strong spirit belief in spirits there. And he knew exactly what I was talking about and knew about it so much. Like, he has a word for it in his language to describe the experience of a ghost sitting on your chest. He's like, oh, absolutely. There was definitely a ghost sitting on your chest. He's like, that happens all the time in Thailand. And so that happened to me there. And I Googled it. I mean, I know there are certain things called like sleep paralysis, but in those instances, the person is in a dream state. Like, they're seeing a dream world around them. They see spiders crawling up the walls or something. That was not the case. I was awake. And when the sensation lifted off my chest, I was still awake. It wasn't like I had the experience of just suddenly waking up. And then I think the last thing that happened frequently in that house was I dreamt frequently of my grandparents who had passed away. And it wasn't just like that I dreamt of them. I dreamt of them as they looked when they were very young, when I did not know them. And I had not seen a lot of pictures of them looking like that. And they were just holding conversations with me. They knew I was getting married. They wanted to congratulate me. They wanted to apologize for missing my bridal shower and just talk to me about my life. And it was very surreal. And it happened frequently, so much. I remember telling my mom, the creepiest one was my grandmother, who had lived with me all through my life growing up from fourth grade on, came to me in one dream and told me she knew how I was going to die. And she asked me if I wanted to know how that was going to happen. And I was, you know, in my dream state thinking of like the space-time continuum, you know, like, do I really want to know? If I find out, is that going to screw up space and time? And I said I wanted to know. Instantly the dream changed, and I was in my childhood bedroom and somebody was trying to break into my house. And I knew who the person was in my dream. It was an attacker that I knew. I run upstairs to call 911, and I can't get through. And I hear the person come in, I lock the door, and I lie really loudly into the phone saying, oh, I hear the sirens coming. I hear you coming. I hear the police. And when the person on the other side of the door hears this, he leaves. And so I woke up and I wrote the dream down. I'm like, man, if someone ever breaks into my house and I can't get through to 911, like, this is how I'm going to save my life. And the dream completely freaked me out. And to this day, since I have left that house, I have never dreamt of my grandparents since. So I feel like something was going on in that house, that there was a thinner veil between me and the other world. And all of these experiences, you know, were legit. They were some sort of existence that something else is out there. And it was definitely in this old haunted house.
Do experiences like that, plus all the research you've done now on possession and exorcisms, Does that at least have the effect of taking unbelief off the table? Like, nope, I don't need to struggle with that particular aspect of faith. For sure, this is a thing, so we can be done with that aspect.
Yes, I mean, I do believe. So I'll say, like, the scariest horror movies are The Exorcist or Paranormal Activity. You know, something, when I saw Paranormal Activity, I couldn't go home. Like, I needed a minute. Like, we had to get a drink. I'm like, we were living in that haunted house at the time. I'm like, I can't go back to that haunted house right now. I need a second to, like, digest what I just saw here. So when you're coming from a place where you believe it, absolutely. It's way easier to write from the point of view of a believer than it is to be a doubter. You know, whether I can convince a non-believer to be scared or to believe in all this, I don't know. You know, like, if that's not where your brain is at, I could say, like, my husband thought my book was scary and he was completely freaked out, and he's not as much of a believer. He's way more of a skeptic than I am. But yes, I mean, I think if you're coming from a place of belief, horror is a little easier. And like I said, you're going to write what scares you, or otherwise, what is the point? You know, so if it's something that interests you or something that scares you, then your own fears will more authentically come through your characters than if it's something that you don't at all connect with. So bringing your own fear into your book, I think, helps it come through to the reader.
The nice thing about horror novels, there's many nice things about horror novels. They're so wonderful. But what makes a horror novel a little bit unique among the many mediums you can experience horror is that if I'm watching a movie or playing a video game, I'm watching The Conjuring, the moment the CGI is a little bit rough, which it is in a few spots, mm-hmm. I'm like, oh, I don't believe this anymore.
Yeah.
Or that's, I can see why you might think that's scary, Resident Evil, but I don't think it's scary. Whereas with a novel, I have to participate with you. I have to build part of that world or in my head, or it doesn't work. And so in my head, I'm also bringing all that weird stuff that happened to me from childhood, all that memories, and I'm helping you build something that is uniquely terrifying to me. Mm-hmm. Which is just something, an observation I just love about horror fiction. You have to participate.
Absolutely. But to me, I feel like there's a little bit of an occupational hazard as a consumer of horror now. I am now more easily scared by TV shows and movies because that is not what I do. So I'm not watching the movie and thinking, oh, that's an interesting camera angle. I wonder how they pulled off that, you know, edit effect or something. Like, I'm not caught up in the minutiae. Whereas when I'm reading a horror novel now, I'm like, oh, that's a really interesting sentence. Or, wow, I love how they set the mood in the scene. Look at the sensory detail here. This really has me going. You know, so I'm sort of looking at the mechanics of the book and I'm a little into work mode. Like, I can never just read a book now. I'm constantly looking at the sentences and critiquing it, whether I want to or not.
I had a quick, I wanted to ask you one more question about cults, then I'm going to ask you about agents, and then we'll think about landing this thing. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to ask you, now that a fair portion of the country seems to be in some version of a death cult, they just do, what do you think, how do we get out of this thing? What do you foresee happening to get our friends and family back into rational land?
I don't know, because I believe those memes where people say, if the internet existed, would polio still exist? And I think there is some truth to that, you know, that the misinformation was spreading when all these other vaccines were invented. Would these diseases still be around? So in that degree, I don't know. I mean, you're going to hit a point where certain vaccines are just required. You know, I can't send my kids to school if they don't have their MMR vaccine, they don't have their various shots. I mean, from the minute you leave a hospital with a newborn baby, they're shooting them up with vaccines, and it is by law requirement. And they're gonna hit that point eventually with COVID. When that point will be, I don't know, but you're gonna have to get your kids vaccinated at some point. You know, so it will take personal choice out of the equation, you know, when you've been conditioned to vaccinating your kids for other things in order to send them to school. This will probably become part of it. how to get rid of the disinformation angle. I mean, I'm not going to get into the technical thing of, you know, what Mark Zuckerberg needs to do to get the act together and change the algorithm and try to fix all of this. But I will say that the temperatures will go down. One of the reasons that Biden makes the great next president after Trump is because he's so boring. You know, like you need a couple of really boring presidents in a row to get the temperature down in this country, whichever side, Democrat or Republican, you know, to just bring the temperature down to normalcy a little bit. So that I think is what will stop the cold. I mean, and the other thing is taking this one particular actor out of the equation. So whatever happens legally with certain political people, you know, could have a lot of effect on what others believe. But I think, yeah, I think just really making politics boring again. Forget making America great again. Let's make politics boring again. Let's get to a point where nobody watches CNN. None of us were watching CNN before unless we were in an airport. So like, let's get to that point where like we're not consuming as much media as we were before. And I think that will change some of our relatives who are trapped in this disinformation mindset.
I hope so. I would really like to live in that world.
Yes.
Although one of my favorite running jokes between my wife and I this year has been, you know what the president tweeted today? No, me either. Isn't it great? We have no idea.
Yes, I don't like, I went all through those 4 years, I would literally wake up, roll over, grab my phone and check what was trending on Twitter because it was constantly the end of the world. Like it wasn't even what was ending the world yesterday. It was an entirely new set of just crazy circumstances on Twitter. And it was every single day. And now since for the past year, I don't do that anymore. I don't wake up and grab my phone and check to see what's trending on Twitter unless it's book Twitter. So that has been a nice change for my own sanity. And I hope if we continue on this vein for a lot longer, we might see politics get just as boring as we all know it should be.
That would be wonderful. I hope it happens. Yeah. Let's talk briefly about agents and film options, and then we'll call it a night here. But I know that your agent, Lane Haymont, sold the book during a pandemic, and you were able to meet her during PitMad. So how does that work?
So I've had many agents. I'm very open about this because I sometimes feel like there is a heavy veil in the publishing world and people don't really understand how hard it is or what goes on behind the scenes. So I have had 4 agents, okay? And I want to be open about that experience because I think a lot of struggling writers out there may believe that, you know, I just get this agent and I have accomplished my goal and it's all over and it's all going to be sunshine and roses and everything's great. And you hopefully it will be sunshine and roses, but it doesn't mean that one agent is the one that's going to stick with you for your whole career. Maybe it will. And like there are authors who had that experience and that's lovely for them. But I also know plenty of authors who have 3 or 4 agents like myself. So for me, I signed with my first agent. I had queried for only 2 weeks. I got super duper lucky. I got an agent in a big New York City agency and she tried to sell 2 books for me and was unable to sell them. So Amour and Summer Secrets is actually the 3rd book I ever wrote, but the first one to sell to a publisher. And that sold to Kensington in the 3-book deal. So I was super excited and I really liked her. We became really good friends. We were about the same age and a lot of our relationship was very friendly. But ultimately, she ended up leaving agenting and I had to go out and find my second agent. And that agent I found through personal connections. At this point, I had written 3 books. So I was able to get some referrals. I only queried, I think, 5 people and one of them offered representation. I worked with that agent for about 2 years. She was trying to sell Proof of Lies, which she wasn't able to sell at the time. That was the first book in my spy thriller trilogy. So we parted ways after this book didn't sell. And, you know, I had come up with some other ideas that weren't gelling with her. So then I had kids and I kind of took a break for a while. I had been writing proof of lies for about 7 years, all told. I think I started it when I was with my first agent. She had tried to pitch it unsuccessfully. Then my second agent tried to sell it. Then I take a break when I have kids. I decide I want to get back into writing. And I'm like, I'm going to try to write this book again. Like, I'm going to try to write Anastasia Phoenix. That's what that's the main character's name. I'm going to try to write it again. I mean, I think even my husband thought I was crazy. My mom probably thought I was crazy, but I really believed in the story. And I needed to find another agent, but I was kind of jaded at this point. I had, you know, been through the ringer. I only queried one agent. She had been my first agent's assistant. She was her intern. And now she was an agent in her own right. She remembered what became Proof of Lies, and she took me on to try to sell this book, even knowing its very lengthy history of agents and rejection. She took it on. We revised it together, and she did end up selling it. So she sold it to Entangled in a 3-book deal. So these books came out in 2017, 18, and 19. But in 2019, when the run-up to the last book, which is called End of the Lie, was happening, I started thinking about, like, what's going to be next? What's coming after Anastasia Phoenix? So I started pitching her different ideas, and she didn't like any of them. You know, I thought maybe I'd go back to contemporary romance. Nope, she didn't like that idea. And then I, you know, pitched a thriller idea. She didn't like that. So then I came up with the idea of what became Small Town Monsters. I watched The Conjuring. I had that experience. I dreamed up Vera. I wrote about 30 pages, and she still wasn't feeling it. And so at that point, you know, you hit this point where you and the agent are just not gelling creatively anymore. And I felt like I was writing for an audience of one. And she saw it too, and we ended up splitting ways. And that was a really hard breakup. Of the three, that was the most difficult one, because she did know me as a baby author, but, you know, she was that intern in the very beginning, and I thought she was going to be with me until the bitter end. But now I kind of see that was like the universe just clearing space and making way for what was to come, because Lane is a completely different agent. So I basically buckled down. You know, I parted ways with this agent. I was, you know, I had doubts, because she wasn't feeling what became Small Town Monsters, but I had enough belief in myself. I had enough conviction in myself to stick with it. I thought I had a really good idea. So I locked myself in my guest room, because like I said, it was a pandemic, and I wrote this book in about 3 months and decided to go back out there. And this time around, I did not go to any connections. I did not go to other authors. I decided to really target the search based on authors who represented horror, and authors who I really respected, and authors who I thought were going to take my career to the next level. So both of my previous trilogies have been published by independent presses, and they were great, and they got me published, and they were distributed through Barnes & Noble, and it was a great experience. But I wanted to get to the big five. I felt like I did my dues. I'd put in those 6 books, and I wanted to see if the grass was greener. I wanted to get to the next level. And I had never sold any sub rights to any of those 6 books, you know, not film rights, not foreign rights, nothing. I didn't even have an audiobook of any of those. So I start querying, and you know, it was probably in the summer when things are a little bit slower. Maybe I sent out about a dozen queries, and then I log on and I see that Pit Mad is happening, which, if you don't know, Pit Mad stands for Pitch Madness. It's actually an offshoot of author Brenda Drake's Pitch Wars, which is a really great program for an author who may be looking for a mentor. It's a little hard to get into, but you basically, you know, pitch your book and submission, and published authors will take you on as a mentee and hopefully clean your book up and get it ready to go out there and query. Pit Mad is not limited to just those who participated in Pitch Wars. Anybody can log on to Twitter and participate. So I hadn't known it was coming. I just logged on to Twitter and saw it happening. And I thought, might as well give it a shot, you know? So I'm like, I threw together a tweet, you know, like, and the first tweet
throwing their phones down as they're listening to you say
that. I know, well, see what happens. You know, so I put the first tweet up. I totally screwed it up, because I didn't know I was supposed to put all those other hashtags in it. Like, I only put hashtag PitMat. I didn't know I was supposed to put like hashtag YA, hashtag Latinx, hashtag HAR. So the first one, I didn't get like any feedback on. And then I sent a second one. And even still, I think I only got 4 likes. So that's 4 agents who liked it. Of those 4, Lane Heyman, he was one of them. All 4 requested the full manuscript. 2 offered representation. So Lane was not the first offer. So I got an offer before him and she was pretty quick. So she'd only had the book for a couple of weeks. So then I, you know, went out to everybody and told them I had this offer. Lane read pretty quickly after that. So you basically give agents 2 weeks to read your book, which is not a very big window. So they have to be interested, you know, pretty heavily interested. Lane came back and he offered as well. And then the other 2, both were seriously interested. They just said they didn't have the time to read it in the 2 weeks. And if I gave them more time, they might consider it. And at that point, I had looked up Lane and I knew enough about him that I thought I was leaning that way. And I had 2 phone calls with both of the agents who were interested. And it was interesting. One was just like my first agent. She would have been my best friend. I talked to her for like an hour. Our kids are the same age. She lives in the same town where my husband went to college. I mean, we could have gone and gotten a play date on Saturday and drank a glass of wine. Everything was great. We just socialized. She was Puerto Rican. I mean, we just really connected. I was like, you could be my best friend. I get on the phone with Lane and he's a completely different agent. He was super business and he sold me on my book. Like he was fired up. He's like, I see this as a movie. I see this as going to these agents. He had a whole pitch and a whole sales experience that I had never had before. Like this was someone who really looked at the business in a different way and really pumped me up. And he believed that this book was going to do this and this and this. And I'm going to do this for you. And it was a whole different energy. And I was like, you know, I'm on my 4th agent. I don't want to do that Oprah thing where you keep dating the same man in a different pair of pants. And I felt like I had the same agent over and over again, these women who I loved and were my best friends and who brought my career to the same place. And I felt like Lane was going to do something different. And he did. I signed with him. He is the agent who helped me do the film option for Proof of Lies. So Proof of Lies has been optioned by a producer. It's out there in the world trying to become hopefully a TV show. And he not only sold Small Town Monsters in a pandemic, but his approach to the sales process was totally different. He not only like went out on submission to editors, he actually pitched this to film agents. So for the first time ever, a film agent wanted to represent me. So my other agents had only pitched it to maybe one film agent that happened to work with their agency. If that person said no, that was it. You know, that it never went any farther than that. So he got me an agent at Gotham, which is a big management, you know, book to film firm in LA. She took it on even though it didn't have a publisher. Okay. But she told me during the phone call, look, I really can't pitch this until it gets a publisher. So this is a pandemic. This sucker is just sitting on people's desks. Nobody's reading anything. And I found that in particular, editors were not jumping to read horror in the middle of a pandemic. Like they wanted to read happy contemporary, you know, rom-coms, you know, like they wanted something uplifting, not something that was going to bring them even darker. So it sat on my editor's desk, who ended up picking it up for 7 months. She had gotten it in the first round of submissions and hadn't looked at it. One of the reasons she looked at it is because the film agent ended up pitching it to a couple of big Hollywood producers who produce horror movies. And one of them was very interested. Lane went back, told all the editors this, and all of a sudden we start getting responses. You know, so it had been sitting on their desk for 6 months or so. And now that they hear that there's a little Hollywood interest, you know, we got an offer. And I think that, you know, so Lane's whole perspective to the submission process was new to me and it was creative. And I think it's what needed to be done in a pandemic to get a horror novel read at that time. So the book came out, you know, it sold to a Big Five and I got to have my Big Five experience and see what it's like, which has been a lot of fun. And it is still like seriously out there with Hollywood, you know, so it's being repped by this agent and I've had a few conversations, you know, with various producers, but nothing has happened, you know, yet. I haven't signed any things yet, but things are moving in a way that is exciting and optimistic and is very different from all of my past publishing experiences.
And how has being with the Big Five at long last differed from being with a smaller press?
I mean, the cover process was different. With all of my other books, I had zero say in the title or the cover. So my editors came up with all of them. I mean, with The Mourn Summer Secrets, I didn't see those covers until they were so done. I couldn't even suggest making my name slightly a different color. Like nothing, they would do nothing. It was done. With Proof of Lies, it was very similar that they were not letting me in on the process of what the cover was going to look like. And I had met with my editor. She had told me what she had seen, and it is not the cover that came to be. They had initially created all these completely different covers that had a whole different vibe. I ended up finding it mistakenly because it ended up on an Entangled brochure in an early draft. It looked kind of like Miami Vice. It was like white. It had like a boat and like an 80s font. It was totally, totally different. And thankfully, Entangled is in a partnership with Macmillan. And Macmillan does the sales and distribution. And it was Macmillan who kept saying no to the covers until they finally got to this cover. But again, I didn't see it until it was done, until it was completely done. So I was allowed to have no feedback. With Small Town Monsters, man, I got to see like the earliest sketch. Now I didn't come up with the title, but many authors don't, you know, I got to see a list of titles and offer some opinions and stuff. And this was on the list of titles. And I do love it. I think it's an awesome title. The cover, I mean, I got to see like black and white sketches of it. When I saw the first black and white sketch, I thought that was the finished cover. And I was like, wow, it's cool. I wasn't expecting black and white, but it's great. Like that's how good the first sketch looked. So like getting to see it like finished and in color was super fun. And we had tons of meetings about it. I mean, the cover designer does the concert posters for the Dave Matthews Band and the Grateful Dead. And like, he's an artist in his own right who sells his own artwork and prints. So it was really cool to work with him. And the editorial process was a little bit different. I also had my first audio book, which is super awesome. And I got to pick the narrator for the audio book. Like they sent me like a whole bunch of different voices of different actors. And I got to pick the one that I thought sounded most like Vera. And that was so, so fun. So the narrator for my audiobook is the same Latina actress who read Mexican Gothic. And I mean, she just has such a creepy, eerie voice that when I heard her read the first chapter, I'm like now self-conscious to read my own first chapter at like book signings. I'm like, she does it so much better than me. Yeah. So it's been fun. I love it. And it's, I'm glad I hit this point in my career. And like I said, I really do feel like sometimes the universe clears things out to make way for you. You know, they say, you know, you got to dream bigger than sometimes you even dream for yourself. And you need to kind of take that big leap. So in the beginning of my career, it was like 9/11 telling me to stop doing this, you know, go find your passion. And then this time around, maybe it was a pandemic, you know, like telling me, you know, it's time to get to the next level. You're here now.
Diana, I've watched our time. It's all gone. What a fantastic Halloween episode. What a privilege. What a pleasure. Thank you so much for making time for me, for making time for esteemed audience. My last question for tonight, although I know you're going to keep publishing, so I hope we'll do this again sometime. Mm-hmm. But for tonight, my final question is always some variation of, If you could go back toward the start of your career, middle of your career, wherever it would have been useful to you, and give yourself some advice that would have made a difference for you and might make a difference for everyone watching or listening to us right now, what would you go back and tell yourself?
I mean, if I look back on the biggest struggles that I had in my career, it was usually related to the rejections and being really down on yourself when you get all of those rejections and doubting yourself and being afraid to leave an agent or when you do part ways with an agent, feeling like this is it, it's over, it's never going to happen for me, you know, like I'm damaged goods, all of that. So if I had known in the beginning that eventually after 7 years and three agents, and I think the total is 70 some rejections from editors, the proof of lies would ultimately be published. It would be nominated for a thriller award. It would be optioned for film. I don't know if I would have, it would have saved me a lot of tears and a lot of stress. I don't know if I would have been able to even believe that was possible at the time. But it wouldn't have happened if I had given up, that's for sure. So there were many moments in my career where I could have easily given up, whether it had been when my agent left, first agent left the business and I would have been too scared to go out and find another one. Would it have been after a million rejections? Like I said, I had two books that failed to sell in the very beginning of my career. I could have easily given up after that and kept beating a dead horse. And instead I kept writing another book. And writing another book. And like I said, Proof of Lies, when I say I wrote it for 7 years, I rewrote it. I started over for 7 years. So I was not beating a dead horse. You know, it's a drastically different book. I ended up learning from that rejection and being able to accept constructive feedback in a way that I may not have been able to in the beginning of my career. But you have to keep going. You have to keep working on your craft. You have to believe in yourself when maybe even your spouse and your mom thinks you're crazy. If you think you've got something, keep going at it, but don't get stubborn about it. Like in terms of not listening to the feedback. I got a lot of feedback on Proof of Lies. It was my first thriller. And they said it sounded like a wild goose chase because I didn't know how to plot a novel. My first series I wrote by the seat of my pants. And basically at the end of 7 years, I realized I had to plot a thriller. I had to plot a horror novel. I needed an outline because your character can't find clues if you don't know what the bad guy is doing and what clues are going to be left. So if I had listened to that feedback earlier on in my career, I probably would have saved myself a lot of pain, a lot of tears. But yeah, and at the end of the day, you know what I did when I parted ways with my third agent? My husband's gift to me for my birthday was a punching bag. And I went downstairs during the pandemic and I was like kickboxing and punching it out and it worked. So sometimes you need yoga and sometimes you need a punching bag and do what you got to do, but keep going at it because if I had given up, I wouldn't be here.
That's the perfect note to end on. Where can esteemed audience find you online, follow you on social media and all that good stuff?
I should have totally pulled out all of my links. I don't have them off the top of my head. Okay, so obviously my website is DianaRodriguezWallach.com. I own all of my domains, so it's even DianaRodriguez.com and DianaWallach.com. So you can find me there and you'll find my social there. I'm on Twitter. I think I'm Diana R. Wallach on Twitter. And I think on Instagram, I am Diana Wallach Author. Okay. But if you don't see me there, you'll find the links on my website. You know, I'm on everything, Goodreads. I'm not on TikTok yet because I feel like an old lady when I go on there and it scares me, but I am definitely on Twitter and Goodreads. So please leave me a review if you read the book and yeah, send me a shout out through my website.
As always, esteemed audience, head to middlegradeninja.com for all the world's best interviews with all the world's best people. Download your free copy of the Book of David, Chapter 1 by Robert Kent, just in time for the Halloween season. You know you want a scary tale. After you finish Small Town Monsters, start the Book of David. You're going to have a great time. And as always, God willing, I'm alive. I'll see you next week.
Thank you so much for having me. This has been great.